Thank you. And again, I'd like to thank Father Legg for inviting me to be part of this. I've always enjoyed coming to the Dominican House. It's the conversation is so rich here that it's something to be prized. I'd also like to dedicate this talk to Father William Wallace. May he rest in peace. The idea for this talk actually came from a foray that I had to engage in going into contemporary bioethics for a project I was involved in at Notre Dame. And the way I would sort of describe the prospect of a Catholic entering into contemporary bioethics is something like this. Midway in life's course, I awoke and found myself in a dark wood, confronted by three beasts. So if you want to go into contemporary bioethics as a Catholic, you have to be prepared to go through hell. It's a moral wasteland, which is very, very sad. But hopefully you'll have a good guide to take you through. Maybe you'll be able to climb up the flanks of Lucifer, who you will find at the heart of contemporary bioethics. So what drives my interest in failed persons is the way in which person is talked about in contemporary philosophy, used in both metaphysical contexts of asking what it is to be a person, and perhaps more importantly in moral and political contexts of asking questions about who counts as a person for our moral and political concern. I think sometimes we focus so much upon the nature of a definition we claim to understand that we don't recognize how its abstract character can hide from us the reality it seeks to express. So as I see it, a good methodological procedure for getting at the reality is to consider what might be thought to fail to live up to the definition and why. Within contemporary philosophy, the notion of person is often associated with notions of dignity. It is thought that it is important to get straight what a person is, the metaphysics of personhood, so that we can determine which individuals amongst us have the dignity of a person, with its attendant rights and obligations upon us as well as toward us, a kind of metaphysics of morals, if you will. So I want to think about how the notion of person is deployed in contemporary discussions as a starting point for my question about failed persons. On the metaphysical side, person is often thought to mark out beings or things that exhibit significant cognitive capacities for reason and desire related to reason, what would traditionally have been called capacities for intellect and will. Think of yourselves listening to me now, and be charitable in thinking of me speaking to you now as persons exhibiting significant capacities for reason and will. If you desire to remain, it is because of what you understand of me and what I am doing. If you desire to get up and run for the hills, it is also likely because of what you understand of me and what I am doing. Perhaps the notion of person may be stretched to beings that exhibit significant cognitive-like capacities approximating reason, and thus will as we understand it. And I had this example before Candace's talk yesterday, so it's providential, I think. Think of Flipper, the dolphin, or Coco, the chimpanzee. So a preliminary definition of person as deployed within contemporary philosophy might be: a person is a being that exhibits significant capacities for reason and will. The definition allows us to look at various beings and ask whether they are persons, answering in the affirmative if we observe significant reasoning behavior or reasoning-like behavior. If they do, they are persons. If they don't, they aren't. It's at this point that the ethical and political questions start to arise. Considering just human beings, there are human beings that do not appear to exhibit significant capacities of reason and will. Think of very young human beings, for example. But consider also human beings who suffer from very significant cognitive disabilities, either from before or after birth, as well as those who, through some injury in life, lose the significant capacity for reason and enter what is often called a persistent vegetative state, or those very old human beings who simply through the process of aging lose the capacity for reason in any significant sense. There are lots of human beings about which it is at least ambiguous to say that they exhibit significant cognitive capacities for reason and will. I think these considerations are all very familiar to us in contemporary thought, particularly bioethical thought. By the preliminary definition of person we have been given, we thus have many human beings who are not persons. If dignity follows upon being a person, then we have human beings without dignity. And if our moral and political obligations follow upon the dignity of the beings under consideration, these human beings are not subject to the sorts of moral and political obligations we bear towards persons. I won't rehearse in detail where this line of thinking goes, as I think we are all familiar with it. Simply stated, it leads to limiting the scope of what are thought to be our moral and political obligations to a proper subset of human beings, and increasingly to the killing of human beings outside that subset. What I want to focus upon in this contemporary sense of person is the thought that being a person is something that happens to a human being. It's a characteristic a human being can gain, and of course a characteristic a human being can lose. Being a person differs from being human. Being human isn't something that happens to one. It is rather the precondition for things happening to one. But being a person is something that happens to a human being. I want to call this view a little pejoratively, but only a little pejoratively, magic moment metaphysics. I call it magic moment metaphysics. Analytic philosophers could just say 3M. I call it magic moment metaphysics because it seems that becoming a person is just something that happens to a being. We aren't particularly interested in why becoming a person happens to a being. It just does. Similarly with ceasing to be a human being. At some mysterious point, the human being becomes a person and may at another equally mysterious point cease to be a person. Except that Father Thomas Joseph White would likely kill me if I did, I would break into song now thinking about this magic moment metaphysics. And by the way, I'm only going to use three names in this paper, one of which is Father Thomas Joseph White's, and his is the only one that I will use in vain. I've established such a reputation with him that he's always a little fearful of inviting me. So, and then this is why I think Father Legg invited me. So I'm trying mightily today not to live down to his expectations of me. So finally, it is important to acknowledge that there is no account of failed persons here. To be a person is simply to exhibit these significant capacities. It does not involve the conditions in virtue of which these capacities arise, where they come from or where they might point to. You simply are a person or you aren't. Now, I think this account of what it is to be a person, however sketchy for the purposes of my talk, is inadequate. Its inadequacy begins to appear with our recognition that except in the killing fields of contemporary bioethics, we think we have moral and political obligations to an awful lot of the human beings who do not count as persons, according to the definition. At the very least, we have moral and political obligations towards very young children who are born healthy and not with significant cognitive disabilities. I won't beg any questions by suggesting right now that we also have moral obligations toward the significantly disabled and the old. But this notion of what it is to be a person is just a bit too magical to account for our obligations toward other human beings, particularly very weak human beings. And the appearance of significant cognitive capacities is not, in fact, mysterious or magical at all. We all know why significant cognitive capacities appear in children, because that is the stage of development of being human that they enter into in a particular time. It is to be expected. The cognitive capacities arise in them because of what they already are, human beings. We also know why many elderly people lose the significant cognitive capacities they once had, because that is a stage of development of being human that many human beings also enter into at a particular time because they are human. We also know why some human beings suffer from disabilities, because given the kind of beings they are, a certain sort of animal, a human animal, they ought to go into that stage of development, but have not, and maybe will not. And in the case of injury, we have an account of why those human beings suffer. It's an injury they suffer from because of what they are, human beings. If it wasn't expected, then we couldn't make sense of the notion of injury applied to them. What they are, human beings, is the precondition for judging the failure to exhibit significant cognitive capacities for reason and will because of what has happened to them. None of this is mysterious from the perspective of biological, psychological, and social scientific perspectives. For scientific-based thinking, there is no magic moment or mystery tour to the appearance of or failure to appear or damage to such significant capacity. No mystery at all. It's only for the metaphysician that the magic begins. It's a magical mystery to the contemporary metaphysicians of morals because they are simply interested in the necessary and sufficient conditions for the presence of the capacities. By and large, this is what contemporary metaphysics concerns itself with: necessary and sufficient conditions for being something, a mental state, for example, or an object, or a cause, or a game. However, necessary and sufficient conditions bespeak logical relations, not biological, psychological, and social relations or causes. Questions of human biological, psychological, and social development are opaque to the moral and political reflection that kicks in only in the face of the necessary and sufficient logical conditions for significant cognitive capacity. That such capacity is the ordinary and expected stage of development of an individual member of a certain kind, qua member of that kind, is morally and politically opaque and of interest only for answering the non-moral practical question, when can we expect the magic moment to occur? But notice even there the moralists of the magic moment, let's call them magic moment moralists, can't escape the horizon or better specter of the underlying kind or nature in play of the thing in question. No magic moment moralist sits around waiting for his pet rock's magic moment, his oak tree's magic moment, his goldfish's magic moment. Perhaps he waits day upon day for his dolphin's magic moment, or his chimpanzee's magic moment. But more likely, he actually waits upon his child's magic moment, if he has chosen to have a child. I said that there are no failed persons on this account, because according to it, being a person is simply a binary fact. Either one is, or one isn't. One meets the necessary and sufficient conditions, or one does not. On the other hand, if we take human development into account, it is clear on this account that a human being can fail to become a person or fail to be a person. A human being who has failed to develop significant capacities for reason is a human being who has failed to become a person. It should have become a person because of what it is, a human being, but it didn't. Also, for a human being to lose these capacities is to be a human being who has failed to continue to be a person. Such human beings ought to be persons, but they are not. Perhaps only very young and healthy human infants can be said to be human beings who, while not being persons, do not fail to be persons. Because again, we expect that they will become persons. So despite the magic, on this view, it's not so easy to separate the notions of being human and being a person, since it seems that human beings ought to be or become persons, given what we know and expect of being human. Still, this notion of expectation on the horizon of the magic moment moralist's reflection appears to be merely a psychological fact for and about him related to what kind of thing he and his child are, human animals. It's not a moral or political value for him. Now, as I just suggested, I don't think this magic moment moralism can give an adequate account of the obligations toward young infants that we have. At best, I think all it can do is ground those obligations in a projection of our wants and desires as parents, members of social communities and political societies upon these young infants. We want this human being to become a person to which we will bear significant obligations after the magic moment of personhood. So looking forward to that magic moment, we project backwards onto these human beings care and concern for them. A care and concern that is only justified in terms of what they are not now, but may become if we care for them now. Why we want this for these animals is anyone's business, and certainly not required of us. It is an expression of what we want, what we hope for out of our efforts. So much the worse for the severely cognitively disabled. For not only are they not persons, but the hope of them becoming what we as parents or society want and value is inversely proportional to the severity of their disability. The appropriate attitude here is not one of hope for success, but of mourning for our lack of achievement in producing what we want from our reproductive activity, or society getting what it wants in terms of future members and citizens. Indeed, although he doesn't like the language of persons and dignity, this failure as parents to achieve our wants and desires when we give birth to disabled children is at the heart of Peter Singer's argument for infanticide in Rethinking Life and Death. Killing these human beings clears the way for the parents to try again to get what they want. Only some human beings, it turns out, are suitable objects for our projections of the bourgeois Western value of success. However, even if one grants this projectivist account of obligations towards the very young human animal, there's at least some cognitive dissonance and incongruity. Before the magic moment metaphysics, there are no moral facts about these infants other than the values we project upon them as our children, belonging to us. They are like property. If I value my car, I project a value upon it, and I will take care of it. If I don't, I won't. If you know me well enough, or from simply looking at me, you know that there are not many things in this life, the value of which are projections of my wants and desires. Cigars, grilled meat, and bourbon. Perhaps Father Thomas Joseph White knows me too well. But if society, given its values, wants me to value my car, it will take steps to compel me to do so, like car inspections in Massachusetts. Then there are import duties on Cuban cigars, taxes and blue laws in Indiana for liquor, and so on. We have to close the bars on election day in Indiana. So similarly, in the magic moment of the metaphysics of morals, I may not value my infant child, but society, for its own wants and desires, requires that I do care for it, projecting a value upon me because of a value society has projected upon it. But somehow, after the magic moment, everything appears to flip from a moral and political perspective. Now the obligations are thought not to be projections of parental and social values, but rather determined by the metaphysical dignity of the person himself or herself to which we are obliged to respond in certain ways. Even Peter Singer, without the notion of dignity, seems to think there are some human beings we shouldn't ordinarily kill. Although in a pinch, well, perhaps. What was property, a sign of our material success or failure, to be dealt with as we will, becomes a person, a self, to which the notion of property is thought to be an affront to his or her dignity. What happened? Well, it wouldn't be magic moment moralism if we had an answer for what happened. It just did. Out of nowhere, from a kind of quantum fluctuation in the moral void, ex nihilo, as it were, as if lux fiat had been spoken and yet not spoken, young human beings go from having value as the fulfillment of their parents' goals, wants, and desires for success, to being good in and through themselves, a good that will now be the basis for a moral condemnation of their parents' values if they do not reorient them away from themselves and toward a response to their children's own self-possessed personal dignity. This is magical indeed. I think the alternative to such magical thinking is to think of persons in a related but different way. There's an element of truth in the view we've been canvassing when it emphasizes the capacity for reason and will as involved in the notion of a person. But the magical moralizing arises out of the magical metaphysical thinking that refuses to take seriously the metaphysical and moral reality of significant cognitive capacity as a stage of development in the life of an individual of a certain kind. It treats person as if it were a term for an abstract univocal kind unto itself, and I couldn't have agreed more with Candace's point about this yesterday. It treats a person as if it were a term for an abstract univocal kind unto itself rather than as a family resemblance term potentially applied to very different kinds of things engaged in very different forms of life. It assumes that if a lion could talk, we would understand what it is saying. The definition of person we have been speaking of runs aground because it speaks ambiguously of a being, in a being with significant cognitive capacity. There's at least one ambiguity in the notion of being used in the definition, namely, whether we mean an individual simply, or we mean rather a kind of being. The magic moment metaphysics of morals uses it in the sense of an individual simply, which is more clearly expressed with the word thing, as in a thing with significant cognitive capacity. But if that is what is meant by a being, namely a thing or individual, it's not as if the magic moment moralists escape the notion of a kind lurking in the background. What is playing the role of a kind for them is the notion of person, specified as having significant cognitive capacity, without reference to the nature of more fundamental kinds of things that can have that nature of a person. Person is the kind, and then we might think gods, angels, dolphins, chimpanzees, humans, and even Martians, all fit within that kind, whatever other kinds of things they are, namely gods, angels, dolphins, humans, and Martians. But this sense of being as individual leaves it mysterious why it is that gods, angels, dolphins, and human beings can be called one kind, persons, while being such different kinds of things. Consider angels, for example. Do angels become persons, like human beings seem to do for the magic moment metaphysicians? If not, why not? In the case of the human, becoming a person is possible because of the other nature the individual has, namely the nature of being human. By contrast, being a person is just something an angel seems to be, not something it becomes. But if being a person in the human case is existentially and metaphysically dependent upon the nature of being human, how can person be the same kind in an angel and in a human being? In conceptual abstraction, we seem to have similar descriptions, while in existential reality, we have quite different kinds of personhood. On the other hand, the notion of being in a being with significant cognitive capacity could just as well express the notion of a kind of thing rather than an individual. Instead of being an additional nature, being a person is simply a more specific expression of the fundamental nature in view. So a much older definition of person is, a person is an individual substance of a rational nature. This definition is both like and unlike the definition of the magic moment metaphysician. It's like the earlier definition in its reference to the notion of reason. It's also like it in using the notion of an individual. However, it's unlike it in its use of the notions of substance and nature. Indeed, simply as a matter of history, one might think the notion of person we've been looking at so far is nothing other than the residue or inertia of the older definition once substance and nature have fallen off the philosophical scene. I don't want to spend much time with the notion of substance in this new old definition. It marks a contrast with what we might call individual accidents or individual features of something, like the color of its skin or the mass of its body or the relation to this set of parents rather than that set, and so on. The substance is what has these individual features, but being a substance isn't another feature had by something or individual. Substance is what the thing is as existing, not what it has. It's the condition for its being a subject of those other features that it has. Fundamentally, for a thing to be is for it to be a substance. If we allow that there are individuals like these accidents and relations that are not substances, the color of my skin versus the color of your skin, for example, then it marks an important difference to put individual substance in the definition of person. Because we are ruling out that the notion of person involves an accident that a substance would have, rather than what a substance is. It excludes precisely the position of the magic moment metaphysician, in which being a person is an accident of whatever individual has it. That's why the magic moment moralist can have human beings who aren't persons, just as we have human beings who aren't white. So we begin to see the difference between the two definitions. So looking more closely at the new, old definition, we should recognize that substances are specified by natures. There are no pure individuals that acquire a nature. If an individual substance ceases to have its nature, the individual substance ceases to be. So our new, old definition of person speaks of a rational nature rather than a rational capacity, as our old definition had. And the difference between rational capacity and rational nature turns out to be crucial for figuring out whether there can be failed persons. So what is meant by nature in the old definition, in the new old definition? Well, in the first place, a nature is what we define when we seek to specify a kind. So I just said a moment ago that to be an individual substance is to be of a nature specified as a kind. So there's the nature of a species of feline that we try to define in biology, supposing that feline is either a lion, a tiger, a jaguar, or the breeds of the animals we foolishly claim to have domesticated when we speak of house cats. In the case of a human person, we might say that human nature is defined as rational animal. What matters to an adequate understanding of the nature of a particular kind of animal is how the very general similarities shared with other animals work in concert with one another in a way different from the way they work in concert together in a different species. We should acknowledge, for example, that other animal species engage in complex mating behavior specific to the kind of animals they are. But then look at how they differ as well across the specific natures of those kinds of animals in their mating behavior. And then look at wedding feasts among human beings. It's a complex mating behavior for the society that points to the mating behavior of the individuals involved that will follow it, and beyond the mating behavior as courtship that preceded the feast. In a way, the feast is the social culmination of the mating behavior of the individual couple. However, it's not just a difference of degree from other animals. It's a difference of kind. The human community comes together to celebrate the public importance of private sexual acts. Why? Presumably because through the reflection of reason upon sex in human life, there's a social recognition of the importance of private sexual acts to the ongoing existence and good of the public community, and a celebration of those private sexual acts that wills them as good. Lux fiat. And a celebration of those private sexual acts that wills them as good. So you can tell I'm not God, by the way, because I said lux fiat, and he's God. Although I suppose if I commanded him, what does that make me? I am the one beyond being. And a celebration of those private sexual acts that wills them as good, not simply for the individuals involved, but for the community itself as more than the individuals themselves. What is done in private is of public importance and celebrated publicly for that reason. So human activity differs from similar activities found in other animals because of the way reason informs it as the intelligible structure manifest within it, not just the reason of individuals, but the common reason of a society. So in the human case, we have to acknowledge that reason and will play a very significant role in reflecting upon, understanding, and willing the goods involved in animal life, a life that is intrinsically social. In that respect, reason is not an add-on to our kind of life as animals, as it appears to be in the earlier conception, a mere accident that some of us possess, separating us from the beasts, providing for another form of life, a non-animal form of life. No, it is rather the specific form of our beastly life. It isn't just that animal life is intelligible within us. We already knew that about animal life from the study of lions and tigers and bears, oh my. It is that the intelligibility of this animal life is the result of the animal's own understanding its animal nature, and willing the goods of that animal nature as understood, giving that specific form to what we do as animals. Yes, reason distinguishes us, but it does not distinguish us from animals. It distinguishes us as animals. That's why reason is not a distinct kind that could be added up on top of the animal kind the person happens to be. What the contemporary definition, a being with a significant capacity to reason, attempts to do is specify a kind on the basis of a capacity rather than a nature. What it ignores is that capacities are not free-floating, but are determined by the natures of the individuals that have those capacities. Yes, almost all kinds of animals have a capacity to reproduce, but the actual capacities they have are specified by the natures they are. The capacity to reproduce as a cat is different from the capacity to reproduce as a worm, is different from the capacity to reproduce as a human being. Similarly, for reason, it may be that there are other animals with the capacity to reason, as there are other animals with the capacity to reproduce. I'm not going to argue about that. But if we want to understand them as persons, we have to understand their capacity to reason in relationship to the distinct natures they express. So in asking whether there can be failed persons, we have to ask what kinds of persons are we talking about? Gods? Angels? Dolphins? Let's confine ourselves here to human persons. What would it be to be a failed human person? We saw in the contemporary account that we couldn't make sense of failed persons. One is either a person or one is not. And on that account, it isn't that human beings in the earliest stages of life or human beings with significant cognitive capacities or very old human beings who have lost the capacity to reason are failed persons. They just aren't persons at all on that account. But now we can see that that conclusion rests upon the magical assumption that one can speak of a capacity without speaking of the nature of the thing for which the capacity develops. If I'm right in thinking that that is the hocus pocus of magical metaphysical moralism, what should we now say with our new old definition? A person is an individual substance of a rational nature. Now we have to understand the capacity to reason as expressive of a particular nature. So we have to think more seriously about human nature. I said that nature as it appears in this account of person is what we specify when we give a definition. But there's a danger in focusing too greatly upon the definition, even our definition, of mistaking the definition for the thing defined, and failing to recognize how the abstract character of a definition can hide from us the reality of the thing defined. With a definition in hand, perhaps expressed as specifying necessary and sufficient conditions for being a person, one asks of an individual, does this individual meet the necessary and sufficient conditions? If yes, yes. If no, no. Nothing simpler has ever been said. But what this abstract feature of definitions hides from us is that the thing defined, the nature, is the intrinsic principle of what is characteristic about some individual substance. It isn't imposed upon it from the outside, but is rather expressed from within. This is most easily seen in the case of material substances, the sorts of things we are most familiar with, and even more so in human beings as material substances. The definition is abstract and static. The nature defined is concrete and dynamic. In material substances, it is the internal principle of the characteristic stages of development that the substance proceeds through in its maturation and also its decline. It is characteristic of material substances, particularly living material substances, that they develop over time from states of lacking certain features to states of possessing those features. Sometimes the features acquired and possessed come from some agent acting upon the material substance, like putting a collar on one's dog or cutting its hair. But what is significant about living material substances that marks them out as a certain nature is the characteristics they acquire and come to possess in virtue of principles within themselves rather than from without. The shape of the neck of the Labrador upon which we place the collar, or the growth of his hair that we seek to clip. More significantly still, the capacity to metabolize food in acts of nutrition, the capacity to reproduce, the capacity to move coming from within oneself, and in the human case, the capacity to reason. What these capacities are developmental stages in the life of an individual, what these capacities are developmental stages in the life of an individual of a certain sort of nature. And they give expression to the nature that precedes them and upon which they depend. An existing nature of a material substance is not a principle of stasis. It is rather a principle of dunamis. The force or movement toward the achievement of a distinctive goal or goals. So the different ways in which material substance develops give expression to the different natures that drive the development from within. You don't understand what is meant by the nature of a substance if concentrating on the abstract character of a definition, you miss the inner dynamism of existing material natures moving toward the development of a goal. Now, once we've acknowledged that the nature of living material substances involves dynamic processes of development, two things become clear. First, the definition we give of the nature of a substance may, in its abstraction, hide this dynamic character from us. Rational animal may be defined as a substance characterized by growth, nutrition, reproduction, and reason. What lies hidden from us in the definition is that such characteristic capacities arise in the life of the human animal over time. They aren't, in that respect, logically necessary and sufficient conditions. Consider reproduction. The definition of anything living will involve the capacity to reproduce. And yet there are living things without the capacity to reproduce. For instance, mules and young human children who may be as stubborn as mules. Other human beings who suffer from an injury or disability may not have this capacity. And yet even though the capacity to reproduce is not present, we have no reason for concluding that the human being involved is not a living thing, because we can give an account in terms of human nature as to why the capacity is not present, either through stage of development, injury, or disability. Second, and related to the first, the definition may hide from us the reality of the goal-driven development characteristic of living material substances, goals determined by the natures in play. It's not just that something has capacities for achievement, but that the capacities develop as contributing to the species-specific achievement of a goal beyond the mere having of the capacities. Now, the etymological notion of a nature is not simply to be born, a static event at a particular time, but to be born to run, born to sing, born to love. A static definition does not allow room for notions of success or failure. You either are or you aren't a member of the kind of thing defined. But if, in fact, hidden in the definition of the dynamic nature of a living substance is a goal for that nature to develop in a certain way, then we can speak of success or failure as the kind of thing one is. To be this is to be aiming at that. Success and failure require that the nature one possesses be born to something that one is not yet when born. It may seem odd that in order to be a failure at something, you already have to be it. But that is what it is to have a dynamic nature. Consider games. This woman is a chess player and a successful one. She can't be a successful chess player without already being a chess player. Consider this man. He is a tennis player and a failed one. But he can't be a failed tennis player without already being a tennis player. So if there can be failed persons, we must grant that they must first be persons. So let's think about what would constitute being a failed human person. We saw that earlier, that the earlier definition of magic metaphysical moralism makes no room for thinking about failed human persons. You either are or you aren't a person, and there are many human beings that are not persons according to it. But we can no longer say that of any human beings given the nature of human beings. We've seen that you can't make sense of the notion of a person as involving a capacity to reason without presupposing the nature of the being for which that capacity is specified. So to be a human person, as we understand it now, is to be an individual of a certain nature, human nature, a nature characterized by the development of certain capacities over time. It's not necessary that the capacity to reason actually be present. Lacking the capacity to reason is no more an impediment to being a human person than, as we just saw, is lacking the capacity to reproduce an impediment to being a living animal. What matters for being a person is the nature for which those capacities are developmental specifications. So consider the three groups of human beings that did not count as persons for the magic metaphysical moralist. Very young human beings who have not yet developed the capacity to reason. They are, in fact, persons, because they are individual substances of human nature, which is a rational nature. very old human beings who have lost the capacity to reason. They are persons because they are individual substances of human nature, like the very young. But what about human beings who have suffered some catastrophic injury to their capacity to reason, never to regain it? Or those born with severe disability, such that they have not and very likely will not develop the capacity? Unless one is willing to say that they are not individual substances of human nature, they are persons, human persons. And of course, one must say that they are individual substances, because their injuries or disabilities of reason only count for them as injuries or disabilities given the rational nature they possess. You can't injure an oak tree's capacity to reason. A worm cannot be born with a severe cognitive disability. Only human beings can suffer an injury to the human capacity to reason. And only human beings can be born with a severe cognitive disability of the human capacity to reason. So on that account, on the account I've been developing, all human beings are persons, no matter the stage of their development as human beings, their injured status as human beings, or their disabilities as human beings. So now, having argued that all human beings are persons, we can ask, who among all human beings might be failed persons? How does one fail at being a person? One might be tempted to think that precisely because they are persons, those human beings who do not have the capacity to reason or for whom it is severely injured or disabled are the failed persons. But that would be a mistake. Success or failure as a person has to be understood with respect to the goals pursued by persons through their doings and their actions. But there are many goals human beings pursue and achieve that are not expressions of their reality as persons. The beating of the heart, the pumping of the lungs, the digestion of food in the gut. Human beings achieve goals here without those achievements being pursued precisely because they are persons. On the other hand, there are goals human beings pursue precisely because they are persons. Walking to the store, grilling bistecca alla Fiorentina, making love to their wives or husbands, worshiping God. These are achievements that give expression to the reality of being a person because they proceed from the capacity to understand the goals involved and to put order into the pursuit of them precisely because of what is understood about them and their relationship to one another. I understand the good of my heart beating, but that understanding doesn't enter into its achievement, except in the rare case where I take medication to speed it up or slow it down. But then I actually have to, in a sense, act upon it externally in order to do that. It doesn't come from within. But on the anniversary of my wedding, I grill 3 2-pound porterhouses for my wife and kids, pour over them the best olive oil I can find, the steaks, that is, not the wife and kids, serve them with pasta quattro formaggio and grilled asparagus on the side with a nice Toscana Il Ducale. Then my daughter serves us her homemade cannoli. That, my friends, if I may say so, is success at being a person, if only for a day. Visit me, you'll see what a difference a day made. I won't rehearse for you here the many daily failures. I save that for the confessional. Is there a priest in the house? But such success doesn't just presuppose my being a person, because I am a human being. It presupposes, in addition, my being able to bring the capacities of reason and will to bear upon the achievement of what I am doing. I fail if I bring reason and will to bear upon it in such a way that I do not achieve the goods I have set my sights upon. But if I cannot bring reason and will to bear upon those goals for some reason, then I don't fail. I am a person who for some reason cannot pursue the goals of a person. I am a person who neither succeeds nor fails as a person. That may seem paradoxical, but consider a chess player prevented from playing chess. Would we say he failed to play chess if, for example, someone stole his board, or he was called away by the sickness of his child, or he was knocked unconscious? He is prevented from playing as a chess player, but he hasn't failed. Perhaps if he's so hung over the day of a match that he cannot play, we may say he failed as a chess player. But that is only because of the way he used his reason and will in such a way that prevented him from achieving the goal of playing chess. So even that failure presupposes the use of reason and will. So the very young human being, the very old, the severely disabled, are all persons, but they do not fail as persons because precisely as persons, they are prevented for various reasons from acting as persons. Again, you need to be a person to be prevented from acting as a person, but you can, and that would be my claim there. To fail as a person, you have to be able to act as a person. So who then might be failed persons, if not the very young, the very old, and the severely disabled persons around us? Well, there are many goals we pursue as persons, and there will be arguments as to which of those goals are genuinely important and whether they can be coordinated with one another into a kind of unified whole, whether that coordination is a simple product of one's own choices or whether something about the prior nature of the goals themselves enters into that coordination. I don't have time to consider all those issues here, but in fact, the goals do enter into coordination set by the nature of those goals prior to the choices, just for those of you who are interested in natural law questions. I want rather to focus upon one feature of the lives of human persons that is necessary to any success as persons, and yet may also be hidden by the abstract definition of person we have been considering. The definition appears to stress that a person is an individual, but hidden in the rational nature part of the definition is the fact that human nature is inherently social because it involves the life of animals. In particular, as animals, we are social in part because of the ways in which we depend upon one another for the achievement of the goals that we have as human beings. It is almost impossible to think of an activity we engage in as persons that does not involve dependence upon other human beings for its accomplishment, however much its accomplishment may most properly belong to us, the individual. For the food we eat, to the fields we study, to the games we play, the sidewalks we walk upon, or the nature reserves we amble through, to the wives we marry, to the children we raise, to what have you, a clear-sighted vision of reality requires that we acknowledge our dependence upon others for what we achieve and our success. And because in acting with one another as persons to achieve these goals, we bring reason to bear upon those goals and will them as socially embedded, we can properly describe this as a life of friendship and solidarity with one another. Friendship and solidarity precisely in our dependence upon one another, in our weakness and our vulnerability. In particular, if I'm right, just as we are persons because we are human, we are also friends because we are human. Being a friend to other human beings is no more a choice we make than is being a person. But like being a person is something we can succeed or fail at, because the friendship we are born to finds expression through actions that involve the understanding of reason and will. Indeed, what I've just said suggests that being a person and being a friend are inseparably tied together for human beings, both in what it is to be a person and a friend, and what it is to succeed or fail as a person and a friend. At the risk of giving you necessary and sufficient conditions, for all X, X is a human person, if and only if X is a friend to human beings. Yes, there are failed persons. Dependence upon one another in our need is a fundamental constitutive condition of our human nature because we are animals, not angels. It is the condition that constitutes human nature as intrinsically social. To pursue the dynamism of our nature is to understand that social dependence that constitutes us as human and to address it through our willed actions. There are failed persons because there are human beings who fail to help those who are in need, particularly the most dire need. These failed persons are human beings who use their reason and will to ignore, avoid, or distract themselves from the sufferings of other human beings. But if you are looking to see who they are among us, look to see who are the failed friends among us. The friends who fail to express human solidarity with dependent, weak, and vulnerable persons. These persons are our friends, not by choice, but by nature. We fail as friends when we do not unite ourselves to them and assist them. There's more we are born to in human friendship and being a person than this, but it is at least this. So when you look in the mirror, ask whether you see a person who is a friend to these other persons. The greatest, most successful human friendship is the friendship that gives the most help to those persons most in need, because it has used its reason and will to acknowledge that it is already bound to them in their need, already bound to them by nature, by friendship. We do not choose our friends, we respond to them. So now in conclusion, I want to preface what I say with the statement that every j'accuse is equally a mea culpa. Sticking simply to those whom we have been thinking of throughout this paper, when you look in the mirror, think of the very young, the very old, and the severely disabled persons whom you help or fail to help out of natural human friendship and solidarity. And you'll either see a successful person or a failed person. What I've tried to suggest to you here today is that thinking about failed persons, when you look in the mirror, you will only see a person with the dignity of the image of God if you've learned to recognize that image first in your friends who are the weak, the vulnerable, the severely disabled, the suffering. All those friends of yours who do not count even as persons in much of contemporary thought. There is a magic in other persons, but it is a deeper magic that is unknown to the magic moment metaphysical moralists. It is the deep magic of misericordia, which, and now I will mention Aquinas at last, Aquinas tells us is the expression of friendship and the greatest of all virtues, because the most godlike. A failed person is a person whose face is not the face of misericordia. May misericordia's mother intercede for us all that we may not be failed persons. Thank you.